Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, offering new and used vehicles to help Mainers explore the beauty of their home state. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Susan Sharon, in for Erwin Gratz, and I'm joined by Maine Public's chief political correspondent, Steve Missler, and senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. Let's start, you guys, with the Maine Senate race, one of the most closely watched in the country. It's drawing lots of heat, generating record amounts of spending. But Mal and Steve, flying well under the radar are state legislative races and control of the Maine House and Senate. Mal, what are you seeing in the way of trends in the legislative races this year? And what are some of the more interesting toss-ups out there?
Well, usually you end up with the Senate being the body that's more easily in play between the parties. And that's true again this year. There are a number of seats that you have to look at and go, boy, is this an interesting race. For example, up in Aroostook County, you've got Trey Stewart, who's the assistant Republican leader in the House, challenging Democrat incumbent, former Attorney General Mike Carpenter. You also have Brian Mahaney, who's the former senator in Hancock County, challenging Louis Lucchini, who's the current senator in Hancock County. Right there, you've got almost like two incumbents running. So those seats are very much in play. You have some open seats, for example, in Bangor, where there's an independent in the race, which of course under ranked choice voting could play a role as that race develops. And then there's Waldo County. Now, Waldo County's been held by the Democrats. It's been held by the Republicans. That's the seat that was held by the Republicans for, was it 3 years, 4 years now? That seat was now in Democratic hands, could flip back. So that's a wide open seat in Waldo County.
Well, there's also a whole bunch of uncontested races, right, Steve? And there's some theories about why those are. How many of them are there, and what does that say?
There are 34 uncontested races for the State House, both chambers this year, and Democrats have 21 of them. That means 21 Democrats are going to run unopposed. They're just going to walk right into those seats. That's a pretty decent advantage heading into the election. And for Republicans, the uncontested races is a troubling trend. I mean, they only had four uncontested races in 2010, which is the same year they took control of the entire legislature and also brought Governor Paula Page into power at the time. But you also asked what's going on here. And I'm not quite sure, but let me run through a few of the theories. One is that there's just been a fundamental shift in the Republican Party orthodoxy under President Trump, and that does trickle down to the local level. We talked about this during the Republican National Convention, but I think it's important to remember that the president has turned the party upside down in terms of foreign policy, trade, immigration, and the party also appears to be about one person's whims. That's the president. So, you know, that's why the RNC didn't update its party platform and essentially replaced it with a unanimous resolution to support whatever he wants, which, as we all know, can change from day to day, hour to hour. Well, there might be some Republicans on the local level who aren't comfortable doing that or even, you know, being identified as a Republican, even if there's less pressure to do what the president wants at the legislative level. And that leads to the second theory, which is that there's just been a fundamental change in the conservative coalition that's dwindling the pool of electable candidates. I mean, we've seen the rise of white nationalism under this president. There's been an embrace, or at least a tolerance among some, of wild conspiracy theories like QAnon. And then there's also the fact that Augusta has become a more partisan place to do business. And if you're not up for that, by that I mean wandering around the halls of the State House in the pre-dawn hours while legislative leaders negotiate $8 billion budget deals in secret while trashing each other in the press, you might not want to run for state representative. And then finally, there's another reason, and it's that legislative leaders have just simply not been able to find candidates. You know, let's not forget that it's legislative leaders that handle a lot of the candidate recruitment, and it looks like they're just having a hard time doing that. And I'll just finish by saying that all of this couldn't come at a worse time for the GOP. I mean, for a decade, the National Republicans have had the upper hand in battles for the state legislature because they realized how important state houses are in advancing conservative causes, especially when Congress is increasingly deadlocked. And in 31 states, state legislatures also draw congressional districts. And that's going to happen again because we have a census coming up, or a census underway. And so Democrats have finally gotten hip to this. In 2018, they poured millions of dollars into electing Democratic legislatures. That includes Maine, and it was certainly true of other state houses in the country. They seem poised to do that kind of investment again. And, you know, for Republicans, you've got to wonder, you know, with Democrats sort of catching on to the idea that state houses are important, it's not a good time for them not to be able to find candidates to run.
And historically, you've got to look at the fact that several of those seats are simply not in a position for the Republicans to contest. There hasn't been a Republican elected from the city of Portland in 30-something years. So those seats are all safely Democratic seats. And you have several other areas the same way. You have Lewiston. The seats are very safe. They're going to stay Democratic. What the Republicans tell me they're trying to do is focus their resources on those seats they think they might be able to win.
Okay, so now let's talk about the flurry of polls that have come out over the past week in Maine's U.S. Senate race, including the one from Quinnipiac University that shows Democrat Sarah Gideon opening up a commanding 12-point lead over Republican Senator Susan Collins. Mal, if there's one thing I've learned from you over the years, is that it's that not all polls are created equal. What do you think are some of the potential flaws with this one?
Well, they didn't poll the two independents. And that is so much more important now than it used to be because Maine has ranked choice voting. The independents could very well decide this race if you look at every other poll that has been done, including the most recent one that the New York Times did. We're all talking 3, 4, 5 point leads for Gideon with margins of error that go 3, 4, or 5 points. So the margin of error means, you know, you literally could have Collins up by one over Gideon in several of these polls that we've got out there. One of the real problems is how do you get a sample that's representative of the people that you're trying to reach, which is likely voters. What is interesting to me is that in this list of polls we've had in the Senate race, all of them are pretty much in the same ballpark, except for this one from Quinnipiac.
You mentioned the poll from the New York Times. It's the New York Times and Siena College. And Steve, that one has Joe Biden leading President Trump by 17 points in Maine and another very wide margin in Arizona. That's the one Mal mentioned that has Collins trailing Gideon. But what do you make of that?
Between the second CD result that showed Biden up, I think, 9 over President Trump, and frankly, the Senate race with giving Gideon a 12-point lead. Those are outliers, without a doubt. And I think it's a reminder of the old polling adage that the trend is your friend. And all the polling that we've seen so far, whether it's in the presidential race or the U.S. Senate race, is that the Senate race is super tight. As Mal pointed out, you know, it shows oftentimes a narrow lead for Gideon, but oftentimes within the margin of error, which means it could be Collins up by 1 or 2. Or Gideon up by 1 or 2. We just don't know. And in terms of the second congressional district, the New York Times Siena College poll, it's definitely more in line with the polling we've seen, which is that Biden has a very narrow lead, 2 points in the second congressional district. And I think that that's, you know, again, that 2 points is within a margin of error. So Trump could be up 2 points there too. The polling average is the thing to pay attention to if you're a member of the public. And thankfully, we have a lot of resources that combine all these polls, and they produce an average. That should be your North Star when you're evaluating these polls. You know, how far out of whack is this particular poll versus what we've seen with, you know, a compendium of others? And I know Mal already made this point, but the Siena poll surveyed all four candidates, including the two independents. And I think that's important. The Quinnipiac poll did not do that, presumably because the pollster just doesn't think that Max Lynn and Lisa Savage are not viable candidates. Well, that may be true. They may not have a chance to win, but they certainly have a chance to affect the outcome, especially if this race heads to a ranked choice runoff, if neither Collins nor Gideon can achieve an outright majority on election night. And with the polls that we've seen, it seems like there's a really good chance of that happening. And in a ranked choice voting runoff, those two independents are very, very important and can have an outsized impact on who eventually is declared the winner of that race.
All right. So another development in the U.S. Senate race is the endorsement from former Defense Secretary and former Senator William Cohen for Susan Collins, who once worked with him. What's interesting, Mal, is that Cohen has condemned President Trump And so I'm wondering what you think of this. Is it surprising, and what weight does it have?
Well, Steve and I were talking about this before we started recording, and you now have a bunch of other moderate Republicans, Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, and Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, now coming out endorsing Collins. And, you know, it seems like someone set up the flare that says we're in trouble from the moderate Republicans, and they're responding by coming out with these endorsements of Collins. And I think we're going to see more of those. I've never believed that endorsements do have much of an impact. And, you know, we've seen very popular folks like Republican primaries where Paul LePage has endorsed a candidate and those candidates have lost, even though he personally is very popular among Republicans. At this point, I think Collins is looking for every bit of help she can get.
This is like the modern Republican equivalent to the bat signal, you know what I mean? Where you've got Larry Hogan, Charlie Baker, and Bill Cohen coming out and saying, you know, we've got to endorse Susan Collins. The only thing I'd add about Cohen's endorsement, it struck me as very personal, which makes sense given his relationship with Collins. And he also seemed angry that Gideon's campaign had been attacking his former staffer. And he even went so far as to describe Gideon's campaign as using Trump-style big lie tactics. That's a quote. Setting that aside, I was struck by this passage in Cohen's column, which I'm just going to read real quick. And it says, quote, "The proper standard for judging Senator Collins or any elected official is not whether you agree with each one of their votes. Rather, it is whether you respect the process they use to make those choices. Did they weigh all the facts? Were they open to all judgments or arguments on all sides of the issue?" So two things about that. First, I'm not sure Maine voters are going to be judging Collins on how deliberative she is before casting her votes. I dare say many of them are going to judge her by her votes because the votes are ultimately what affects them. Second, as I read that passage, I couldn't help but think of the fact that Cohen, in the lead up to the impeachment vote in the Senate, called the president's conduct in the Ukraine matter tantamount to a criminal act. And before that, he wrote a column in the Washington Post chastising Republicans for their countenance of the president's conduct. Collins voted to acquit the president, and she's in trouble with a lot of Maine voters for the very reasons that Cohen himself described in that column. Maybe he doesn't view Collins the same way as he does other Republicans, and that does make sense given his relationship with her, but there are going to be a lot of voters who do.
Well, another point of influence in that race, of course, is the record amounts of money that is being raised and spent. And Steve, you worked on a piece over the past week that to show how Collins and Gideon are trying to undermine each other over the money that's being raised and spent on their behalf. What'd you find out when you did that story?
It makes sense, right, that the most expensive campaign would be decried by the people who are making it very expensive, right? So, I mean, the one thing that we were trying to do with that story was just to separate some of the claims that were made in the first debate. One of them is about dark money, for example, and its prevalence in this race, and it is prevalent. I mean, one thing that Senator Collins said, though, she claimed that Sarah Gideon had set a record with dark money. The problem is that Sarah Gideon has theoretically no control over how much dark money is spent here. That money comes in from outside groups and it works independently of the candidate campaigns. And then the other issue too is that Sarah Gideon has made a big deal about Senator Collins receiving corporate PAC donations, which has become this new front in the rhetorical wars about big money in politics with Democrats in particular, who take these sort of principled stands about not receiving corporate PAC money, but then turn around and get it in through the back door by accepting PAC donations from PACs that do accept corporate PAC money. So that story was really trying to sort all that out. And also this claim by Senator Collins about the Disclose Act of 2012, which would have lifted the veil on groups, nonprofits, trade organizations, and other entities that can hide the identities of their donors. Senator Collins voted against the 2012 Disclose Act, and she did so claiming that it gave preferential treatment to unions in particular. Just to be clear, and we talked to Tony Corrado with Colby College, he's a leading campaign finance expert about this, and he basically said, look, that bill did not give preferential treatment to unions. It, you know, Republicans, they sort of seized that talking point, however, because the Disclose Act set a really high threshold for disclosure, $10,000. And if you think about it, unions derive most of their wealth from union dues, which are not anywhere close to the threshold of $10,000. And so, you know, Republicans were not happy that unions would somehow be exempted, even though they technically weren't. They just wouldn't have met that qualifying threshold. So we just wanted to shed a little light on that, because again, with so much money sloshing around, it's easy for the candidates to make claims and counterclaims about what that money does and how it works. We were just trying to shed a little bit of light on that.
All right, Mal, Steve, thank you so much. That's the main Political Pulse for this week. Our podcast is updated each Friday afternoon. You can find it on mainpublic.org or wherever you listen to or download podcasts. We also broadcast most of the Pulse on Weekend Edition Sunday and have a shorter excerpt on Monday Morning Edition. Willis Ryder Arnold is our producer. I'm Susan Sharon, filling in for Irwin Gratz.